This is Audible.
Organic Marxism, an alternative to capitalism and ecological catastrophe, by Philip Clayton and Justin Heinziker. Foreword by John B. Cobb, Jr. Narrated by Seth Clayton. Foreword by John B. Cobb, Jr. This is an astonishing book. Many of its positive ideas are found elsewhere, but here they are brought together as a new form of Marxism. One would have thought that in the United States, that would be the wrong way to attract interest and support. But as one reads, the reason becomes clear. What is needed now is different from any past form of society. But it is not a revision of the now dominant ideology, capitalism. That provides the wrong starting point. The critique of capitalism in these pages is not simply of some ways in which it operates, but of its most fundamental nature and goals. It cannot be salvaged by reforms. In this critique, the authors build on the thought of Marx. The errors of Marxism, deriving more or less from Marx himself, have been serious. They are clearly stated. Marxism in its Leninist and Stalinist forms did not work and will not work. This fact is in no way obscured. But the basic assumptions and purposes of Marx are not invalidated. To achieve a healthy and sustainable society today is to realize the goals of Marx. That is why the book is calling for a new form of Marxism. Today, more and more people recognize that global capitalism is destroying itself, and in the process, rendering the planet uninhabitable. It is time to turn away from efforts to modify it, and, instead, to look for a new starting point. Perhaps we can sufficiently overcome the prejudices into which we have been socialized to recognize that Marx offers us this new starting point. Far more than American and British scholars, European intellectuals have attempted to update and make positive use of Marx. On the European continent, there exists a rich literature proposing new forms of Marxism that are, the authors claim, free from the errors that have led to the demise of politically important Marxist parties. Too often, however, those who have written thoughtfully treat Marxism as a stimulus for criticism, but not as a real option. A few American Marxists have shown that an ecological Marxism can find grounding in Marx, and this is surely important. But this book goes much further. One can wish that it would become the basis of a vigorous discussion of the basic alternative to capitalism. Both capitalist and Marxist thinkers present themselves as scientific. However, the science on which they model themselves is modern science. Actually, science has moved on. Its findings have broken out of the modern boundaries and call for radical rethinking of the nature of the world. Organism is replacing mechanism in contemporary models. Marxism needs to base itself on contemporary postmodern science rather than an outdated modern one. Hence the call for organic Marxism. The clear implication of this book is that it is a move that Marxism can make, whereas capitalism is inherently stuck with outdated models. This book will have a much easier time gaining a hearing in China than in the United States. China is not now trying to implement any past form of Marxism. It knows the problems from painful experience. But it has not given up on Marxism itself. Some of the directions of development of Marxism for which this book calls are already being considered in somewhat scattered ways. To have a coherent statement of a form that Marxism could take in China may well be appreciated as a direct contribution to the present discussion among leading politicians and intellectuals there. Adopting this term with the understanding offered here could have historic importance in China, and what happens in China is of historic importance for the world. Although the authors list specific policies and practices that would implement organic Marxism, they do not endorse a single set of policies for all cultures and governments. This limitation is the consistent consequence of their understanding. Organic Marxism calls for an economy that grows organically out of the existing cultural and economic situation. With regard to China in particular, the authors do not claim to have the detailed knowledge needed to press specific policies. Chinese, and specifically Chinese in various parts of that vast land, are much more likely to be qualified. Only the knowledge of specific situations can suffice to identify promising next steps. Organic Marxism does not seek to impose solutions on any country from outside. It seeks to empower those best able to make decisions to do so. But suggestions can be made by outsiders to stimulate the thought of those who are locally involved. This book offers many such suggestions. I would myself draw from organic Marxism a more impassioned critique of much that has been done in China in the last decade or two. Organic Marxism is serious about the critique of capitalism, whereas China has opened the door quite wide to that capitalism. This has enabled its economy to grow at an amazing speed, but it has also created false expectations over which it now has little control. It has listened to capitalist experts from the United States, and it has failed to bring a Marxist critique to bear on the capitalist assumptions of their advice. It has copied the American value-free research universities, thereby preparing capitalist leaders for China's future. I believe China still has the opportunity to check this rush into the arms of global capitalism, but it will not be easy. This book could be an important ally in that resistance. I hope that the depiction in these pages of a new form of Marxism that grows authentically out of China's own traditions will help it to change course. May it do so soon. The chances of a serious move towards socialism in the countries of Europe and North America are far more slim. One can nevertheless hope that this book, together with the growing awareness of what capitalism is doing to the 99% and to the world's ecosystems, will have some effect, even here, in slowing the headlong rush toward global destruction. Preface. Why Marx? Many Americans ask us. This is not a question that my Chinese friends ask. They understand that Marxism is written into the Chinese constitution. The governing philosophy of China in the years to come may look quite different from the socialist philosophy that Karl Marx formulated almost 200 years ago. It will still be called Marxism. Things look different to most Americans. They often respond, "But the West tried Marxism at various times and various forms, and it failed. Why do you still think it's a viable option?" It's a good question. Although Americans know that the communism of Russia and China is derived from Karl Marx, very few have ever read Marx seriously. They believe that socialism and communism are identical, and for decades they have heard that both are bad. Basically, Americans have been told that these words mean that the state owns everything and that there is no private property, free market, or human rights. The attempts to implement either socialism or communism, most Americans believe, have shown that the theories are false. We believe these judgments are mistaken, and in the following pages we offer an alternative. We wish to lay our 7 central claims on the table right at the outset. It is urgent that people around the planet recognize the situation that the human race now faces and that we take steps to implement the solutions. Capitalism as a social and economic system has created massive injustices and has devastated the global environment. As we will show, there are real alternatives to capitalism. Far preferable to it, we will argue, is a hybrid system that limits market forces within the context of socialist communities structured for the common good. It is inevitable that global climate change will produce social and economic collapse on many parts of our planet. Out of the dust of that collapse, a new ecological civilization can arise. It's far better for humans and for the planet, however, that we act now, rather than waiting for the full force of the calamity to strike. In the process of naming the problems and moving toward solutions, a form of open Marxism that we call organic Marxism can and must play a crucial role. Here are three reasons why. 1. The core ideas of Marx's work remain compelling. Probably no thinker in the modern period wrote more insightfully on what it would mean to construct society and economics for the common good, and on the ways that power and wealth create government for the few, not the many. Of course, working 150 years ago, Marx made some assumptions that we now know are false. Some of his solutions were composed for the industrial age, not for the post-industrial information and technological age in which we now live. It's not difficult, however, to reformulate Marx's work without these assumptions. The reform program that results, we hope to show, is pretty compelling. If you want to understand the dynamics of multinational corporations today, or the way that the wealthy exercise power over entire societies and the global economy, or how rapidly growing class differences make the upper class increasingly inaccessible to the rest of us, then Marx remains a prescient guide. Part of the American dream, for example, is to deny that there are class lines drawn through the middle of American society. Each year, however, the widening gap between the 1% and the 99% turns that persistent American dream into more of a myth. Particularly instructive in this regard is the famous boast by Warren Buffett, quoted by the Marxist theorist Jürg Rieger. There is such a thing as class warfare, and that his class is winning it. 2. What one learns growing up in America is a caricature of socialism. One is taught that socialism means a police state, Stalin and his death camps, the crumbling factories in East Germany in the 1980s, and, again, the denial of all private property, human rights, and the free market. But none of these allegations is true of contemporary, postmodern socialist theory. Many readers who are attracted to the idea of a relational worldview for the common good have probably never realized that socialism is the social-political philosophy most closely aligned with their own ideals for human society. 3. The world faces a series of crises that capitalism, by itself, will never be able to solve. Consider just two. The first is the excesses of capitalism itself. Corporate selfishness and greed, the ability of the rich to buy votes and hence mold the policies within democracies, the growing inequities between the rich and poor, the increasing vulnerability of the middle class, these are the realities of our global situation today. 20 years ago, they were scarcely named within mainline North American society. They were being named in Europe, South America, and Asia. Today, however, they are widely recognized realities. The second crisis is even more urgent. A nearly universal scientific consensus has emerged that human development is causing a global disruption of our planet's climate system. Among the effects already manifesting are more violent storms, flooding, droughts, rising temperatures, and a rising sea level. With each passing decade, the effects will become more devastating. The problem is not that experts disagree about the future, nor that people don't care. The problem is that the way the global system is currently set up, allowing individuals to amass whatever wealth they can and to spend it as they wish, makes it impossible for the human species as a whole to take the actions that we need to take. For the first time, capitalism has faced a crisis that it is fundamentally incapable of solving. Since the time of the failed Glorious Revolution of 1848, some socialists, though never the majority, have been guilty of an idealism verging on utopianism. There is, however, nothing idealistic about the pages that follow. Thanks to the comforts of growing economies and new technologies, the reach of capitalist assumptions has continued to grow over the last 50 years. Were circumstances to remain as rosy as they have been for citizens of Europe, North America, and a few of the developing countries, the global economic system would not change. But circumstances are changing. Climate disruption has arrived. Scientists tell us it's just the beginning. We should expect to see catastrophic storm damage, flooded coastal cities, loss of fresh water for billions of people, mass animal extinctions, and increasing starvation due to crop failures. This is not science fiction or religious apocalypse. It's what's in store for the residents of our planet in the coming few decades. If the collapse of civilizations in the past is any guide, we can be fairly sure that three things will happen. Rich people and nations will use their wealth to try to buy the resources they want, their technology to try to get the water and food that they need, and their power to fight off poor people and nations who want what they have. People without food, water, or government support will take up whatever weapons they have and begin moving toward the nations that have the food and water that they need. Governments, in battle against their hostile neighbors and increasingly hostile planetary system, will reduce civic freedoms and increase their control, doing whatever they deem necessary to protect their interests and their citizens. If this is the future that lies ahead of us, and the scientific models seem to agree that it is, then there are, we fear, only two options. We can do nothing until the full crisis is upon us, at which point those in power will use their power as they see fit. By and large, the rich with power will survive, and the poor without power will die. Or we can act before the situation becomes desperate. In either case, humanity will be forced to limit the excessive consumption of the rich, whether through taxes, rations, or confiscations. It is just a question of when. We offer this manifesto of society built for the common good, then, as the better of two options. This is what it will look like if humanity acts in its own long-term interest, and in time. When change is inevitable and the other options are worse, the most rational course of action is to do the right thing, even when it's hard. In short, we put this book in your hands as a wager. We wager that, while we still have time, humans will do what is in the best interests of the species as a whole, which means what is in the interest of sustaining life on this planet. We wager that ours is not a suicidal species, an irrational species, or a fundamentally selfish species. Admittedly, no small amount of evidence supports betting on the other side. But maybe, just maybe, these pages will play some role, however small, in increasing the odds that our species will choose life over death, sustainability over extinction. We have written this book not just for scholars, but primarily for policymakers, government leaders, and lay people. We acknowledge many authors in the notes to whom we are deeply indebted. Without their great work, this book would be impossible. But we have fought the temptation to give long expositions of their positions in the text. Nor do we take great pains to point out every disagreement we have with authors whom we quote and have learned from. Without any theory, enduring reform is not possible, but too much academic talk can also block action. We gratefully acknowledge the people without whom this book could not have been written. Karl Marx and Alfred North Whitehead, the two main theoretical sources of the argument. John B. Cobb Jr., David Ray Griffin, and Jay McDaniel, who have helped to synthesize processed thought and constructive postmodernism into an intellectual and practical program. In particular, we have been deeply indebted by their commitment to support ecological and sustainable development in China. John Cobb has written that China is the place most likely to achieve ecological civilization. We share his conviction that, in the entire world, China today is the most fertile soil for the growth of process and constructive postmodern thought. Wang Zhihe and Fan Meijun, directors of the Institute for the Postmodern Development of China, with their work on constructive postmodernism in China and on the Chinese Second Enlightenment, they have been pioneers in supporting discussion of these themes in the People's Republic of China. John Bellamy Foster and Jörg Rieger, Western Marxists whose work has taught and inspired us. Professor Rieger's critique of an earlier version of this book added immensely to the quality of the final product. Elizabeth McDuffie, who assisted us with checking and assembling the text. Our editor, Janine Sledham, for her constant encouragement and her professional supervision of the publishing process. Part 1. Why Marxism? Chapter 1. Introducing Organic Marxism. Many people in developed nations believe, we think wrongly, that they have nothing to learn from Karl Marx. Their governments and their media have told them that it's impossible to implement socialist principles in political and economic systems. The collapse of East Germany and the USSR, the decreased role of communist parties in the European nations, the difficulties faced by socialist governments and parties in Latin America and elsewhere, these are the developments that critics point to in arguing that Marxism has failed as a socio-economic system. Even in the People's Republic of China, where Marxism is enshrined in the national constitution, one hears skepticism about the continuing relevance of Marxist analyses. In practice, most of global economics now functions according to the principles of the so-called free market economy, with disastrous consequences for the planet and much of its population. The domination of capitalist principles has been so thorough that Francis Fukuyama proclaimed the end of history in 1992, arguing that humanity has finally attained its highest and ultimate form of government, Western-style capital-based democracy. Many commentators, especially in the United States, appealed to Fukuyama, inaccurately, as it turned out, to support their belief that free market principles had won a final and decisive victory over every other form of economic system. The advocates of Fukuyama's thesis in the early 1990s would have been surprised to hear that, just two decades later, the public outcry against unrestrained capitalism and against the government policies that support it has grown in volume and influence. Of all the factors causing this change, none has served to highlight the limits of the capitalist system more than the global environmental crisis. Global capitalism has created the greatest ecological and humanitarian catastrophe in the history of human civilization. The unrestrained pursuit of wealth on the part of those with economic power has left approximately half the world's population, over 3 billion people, living on less than $2.50 a day. At least 80% of humanity lives on less than $10 a day. Whereas 40 years ago, the gap between the richest 20% and the poorest 20% on the planet stood at 50 to 1, today the disparity in wealth has risen to 80 to 1. The evidence is overwhelming that the wealthiest nations have designed the world economic system to bring maximum gains to themselves. Under the present system, it is virtually impossible for the poor nations to catch up. Multinational corporations are able to utilize tax loopholes, cheap raw materials, inexpensive labor, free trade agreements, and lax enforcement of existing treaties in order to continually produce the highest possible profits for their shareholders. Unfortunately, the United States is a leader in allowing unequal conditions at home and in supporting unequal conditions abroad. As if the human consequences of capitalism were not enough, the planet itself now moans under the unbearable burden of these practices. No pillaging army in its drive for conquest has had as devastating an effect upon the global ecosystems as international corporations have in their drive for profit. Wealthy individuals and companies continue to use their positions of dominance to rack up short-term gains at the long-term expense of the planet. Now that the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, has brought the conclusions of climate science to public attention, no one can claim not to know the consequences for the planet and for human civilization if we continue to produce carbon emissions at present levels. Yet, unfortunately, our present capital-based economic system requires continually expanding markets. The science is clear. Growth economics has run up against the absolute limits to its growth, planetary limits. It has been approximately 3 million years since the Earth experienced atmospheric carbon levels of the present magnitude, over 400 parts per million. These greenhouse gases have turned our planet into a hothouse, or better put, a pressure cooker. Because of these global developments, support has been growing for a radical shift of the political and economic models that we use to structure human civilization. Central to such a paradigm shift are the society-based economic principles derived from Marx and the history of Marxism. The time is ideal for a return to the enduring insights of Marxist analyses for a very simple reason. Unrestrained capitalism is now threatening civilization as we know it. Diminishing resources, global climate disruption, weakening economies in both the developed and developing nations, these are present-day realities. As humanity draws nearer and nearer to the edge of the massive social unrest and political disruptions will push human societies ever more quickly over the edge. The severity of our planetary situation is a present and urgent reason for forward-looking thinkers to seek solutions beyond the status quo. Nothing less than a shift in the global economic paradigm will allow human nations, cultures, and civilizations to survive in anything like the forms in which we have known them heretofore. If you see that your car is heading off the road and toward a brick wall, you do not keep your foot on the accelerator. The vehicle of capitalist growth economy has left the old, safe road and will soon hit its wall. The consequences forecast by scientists are almost incomprehensible. Melting ice caps, rising sea levels, lack of food and drinking water for hundreds of millions of people, mass starvation, and the extinction of 30-40% of the planet's species. If this situation is not sufficient reason for nations to begin instituting new socioeconomic practices, it is hard to say what would be a sufficient reason. Marxist socioeconomic policies after industrial Marxism. At the same time that unrestrained capitalism threatens to destroy the planet, its major alternative, Marxism, has come under increasing criticism. Many theorists in the West seek to give the impression that it has been largely discredited. In light of this situation, it is not sufficient merely to point out the false promises of capitalism. One must also engage in a careful process of sorting through the legacy of Karl Marx's work in order to establish what a viable Marxism will mean in the 21st century. The program of organic Marxism calls for a number of important revisions and updates of classical Marxist thought and practice. 1. Marxism is not a universal predictive science. The dream of social determinism was one of the many myths of European modernism that must now be left behind. We may not be able to list the objective factors that will predict a global revolution of the proletariat and the advent of a purely utopian socialist society. It follows that no national economy can be managed and controlled by central planning alone. Human ideals and philosophies, and even human religions, play crucial roles in motivating personal and social behaviors across cultures and nations. Marxists today do not dismiss ideas as a mere superstructure, and we do not believe that the forces of production are the only real causal factors in history. 2. Marxists do not need to insist only on state ownership, state-run businesses, and the abolition of all market forces. Most actual socioeconomic systems are mixed or hybrid systems, and are in this sense impure. The push by wealthy individuals and businesses to increase their profits must be constrained and restrained by social policies and institutions at the government level. Hence, central planning and government restraints must play some role. But 21st century Marxists also make room for a limited role for market forces at the local, national, and international levels. Governments that strive for just social and economic conditions for all their citizens do not have to eliminate competition and private ownership. Marx wrote in the context of early industrialization in the West. The solutions he proposed addressed exploitation of workers in the industries of his day, the kind of exploitation that continues today, for example, in the garment industry in developing nations such as Bangladesh. Other parts of the global economy are post-industrial. Marxist analyses still reveal truths about these economic systems, such as global financial markets and the service sector, even though the solutions may not be identical to those that Marx proposed. 3. Marxism was never meant to be a purely theoretical dispute among university professors. The European debate over Marxist theory, long dominated by modernist assumptions, has in recent decades splintered into literally dozens of competing schools. Scholars engaged in increasingly abstract debates concerning the minutiae of their various competing theories, often with little obvious relevance to the realities of governing cities and countries. Theories divided into sub-theories, and schools into sub-schools, until in the end, some critics say, each scholar has become the chief advocate of a school consisting of himself or herself alone. When major Marxist figures and movements did arise, the Frankfurt School, Althusser, Habermas, whose insights began to influence public policy, their followers inevitably began to quarrel amongst themselves, decreasing the practical influence of their teachers. Too few Marxist authors have submitted their theories to rigorous testing in the fires of real politic, and those who have tried to do so in recent years, in Europe, Asia, and Latin America, have tended to work within the assumptions of the present-day global economic system. Only a radical blending of theory and practice in the study and implementation of Marxism will correct the imbalances of the past. 4. Critics are wrong in their claim that Marxism has become a meaningless label for whatever random practices a socially oriented government chooses to impose. A Marxism without real content will not help human civilization through the crisis that it now faces. Not only will its capitalist opponents quickly realize that it is empty of content, the intellectuals, the students, the businessmen, and eventually even the bureaucrats of a nation will recognize it as well. It is all too easy to recognize when Marxist terms are used in a rote fashion and do not actually provide a substantive guiding framework for government policies and initiatives. When one fails to draw clear lines that lead from theory and practice, others begin to wonder whether the language is being used only to maintain the status quo. By contrast, updated Marxist analyses of the dynamics of wealth and power can help leaders to modify unjust systems and implement wise policies. One can welcome positive features in the traditions stemming from Marxist work, while still insisting that many of the classic forms of Marxism need updating, including German, Soviet, and early Chinese theories and practices. From this, it by no means follows that Marxism as such has been superseded or that its core principles no longer have any significant meaning. As the coming chapters will show, the central Marxist insights remain as vital as ever. In fact, given the global situation today, perhaps more so. 5. A vibrant living Marxism cannot be one size fits all. According to modernist European assumptions, only a universal theory, a theory that is applicable everywhere and at all times, can be a true theory. As constructive postmodernism has shown, however, theories grow in, through, and out of their particular contexts, just as a plant grows in a particular soil and ecosystem. The only useful Marxism for our time will be a postmodern Marxism, which means that it will exist only as adapted to a particular time and place. This nation, this culture, this language and history, these particular needs of these particular people. In these pages, we defend a culturally embedded Marxism, a set of core commitments that take different forms as they are applied in different political and economic contexts. Organic Marxism and Ecological Civilization. People make their own history, but they do not make it just as they please. They do not make it under circumstances chosen by themselves, but under circumstances directly encountered, given, and transmitted from the past. The tradition of all the dead generations weighs like a nightmare on the brain of the living. Mark Crowling and James Martin. In the second decade of the 21st century, we find ourselves in a new world, facing challenges that humanity has never faced before. Many around us ignore the writing on the wall. Others turn inward to their own private pleasures and gains. And the most dangerous spend their careers promising that the problems are not really there because science and technology will make them magically disappear. Avoiding planetary disaster will take men and women of courage who think change, advocate for change, and work sacrificially to bring about change. The leaders of the new ecological civilization will need conceptual resources adequate to this daunting task. For their overarching framework, they require a social, economic, and political philosophy that places the common good of humanity and of the planet above all else. Given this goal, it becomes a top priority to diagnose and deconstruct those assumptions of European modernism that history has shown to be inadequate. Unfortunately, Marx uncritically accepted many of these assumptions. If his work is to speak to the needs of our postmodern world, it will need a bold reformation that draws on newly available conceptual resources. Fortunately, the natural alliance between Marxism and environmental philosophy has long been recognized. Already in the 1960s, Ernst Bloch was linking Marxism to the ecological movement, using the expression, transcending without transcendence. Contemporary Chinese Marxism. This book has been written with particular attention to the situation in China today. We made this decision not only because of the sheer size of China's population and its political, economic, and technological power, not only because China is the largest nation in the world to be defined by its constitution as a Marxist state, and not only because the environmental decisions made by the people and the leaders of China will reverberate across the entire planet. It's also because the contemporary Chinese situation raises particularly complex questions about the future of Marxism and capitalism. The somewhat different questions facing Marxists in Russia and Latin America are not less important, but they will not be our primary focus here. That said, we should add an important caveat. The authors are scholars, not politicians, and we are China watchers, not Chinese nationals with special expertise in China's internal affairs. One cannot insist that political theory in a postmodern world is radically contextual while at the same time making pronouncements from the outside on how China should be run. We limit ourselves to the somewhat more general task of reconstructing Marxist thought in this emerging postmodern context, recognizing that internal issues and day-by-day management decisions are the domain of Chinese leaders. What makes China particularly important for organic Marxism is that two things are happening simultaneously. one encounters deep reflection about what the next phase will be in the Sinoization of Marxism, and one also sees a turn to the concept of ecological civilization. As scholars and environmentalists, we believe that the combination of Marxism and ecological thinking represents the most hopeful orientation for political theory and human policymaking. In that sense, this book is no abstract exercise. Since the 17th Congress of the Communist Party of China, the idea of creating an ecological civilization has been an official part of the party's platform and plans. As one reads in Hu Jintao's report, the goal is to form an energy and resource-efficient, environment-friendly structure of industries, pattern of growth, and mode of consumption. With the rapidly growing ecological crisis in China, the urgency of establishing an ecological civilization is becoming a top priority from government leaders to the common people. The idea of ecological civilization reflects an important change in the model of economic development in China. As Dr. Wang Zhihe writes, rather than emphasizing economic construction as the core of development, as it did in the past, the party authorities have come to realize that sustainable development must be based on an understanding of an intertwined relationship between humanity and nature. During the 18th Congress, November 2012, President Hu Jintao made ecological civilization a central theme in his report. At this Congress, the party wrote the task of building an ecological civilization into the Chinese Constitution. As President Hu insisted, we must give high priority to making an ecological civilization, work hard to build a beautiful country, and achieve lasting and sustainable development of the Chinese nation. President Hu's 2012 report integrated these priorities into the plans for China's development over the coming years, emphasizing the importance of preserving farmland for farmers. He held up the goals of green fields, clean water, and blue sky. Xi Jinping, the new leader of China, has voiced the same priorities. Building an ecological civilization, he has said, is a cause benefiting both contemporaries and future generations. It is the thesis of this book that the goal of building an ecological civilization is not foreign to China's Marxist tradition. It is a part of a natural evolution of Marxist thought, both in China and around the world. We thus echo the assessment of Dr. Wang Zhihe. These comments can help us understand why constructive postmodernism has been so well received in China. Constructive postmodernism has deep convergences with Chinese Marxism, such as putting emphasis on process, taking an organic stance, having a strong consciousness of social responsibility, caring for the poor, defending justice, and pursuing the common good. I argue that it is these deep convergences that make some open Chinese Marxists enthusiastic about constructive postmodernism. No one inside or outside China is under any illusions about how difficult it will be to build an ecological civilization, especially when nations and multinational corporations are resistant to changes in the present system. Still, the evidence suggests that the statements by China's leaders reflect substantial commitments. Western leaders, NGOs, and business people will take them even more seriously as they come to understand the growing together of Marxism and an ecological worldview. Hence, our focus on organic Marxism. Conclusion. New resources. The good news is that new conceptual resources are now available for constructing a significantly revised form of Marxism. In these pages, we will explore the developments in the sciences and the philosophy of science that support this emerging postmodern organic paradigm. Among them, ecosystem studies and ecological philosophies play a particularly important role. We have also drawn from cultural studies, which trace the different ways that cultural beliefs, norms, and practices are embedded and embodied in different societies. Too often, Marxism has been taught and implemented as if it were one size fits all. Without sensitivity to cultural dynamics and divergences, neither this nor any other political philosophy can be successfully applied. The final resource that appears in these pages is Process Philosophy. To our knowledge, this is the first book on Marxism written from a process perspective. Some Chinese Marxists are already interpreting process philosophy as a new school within contemporary Western Marxism. As process philosophy begins to play a larger and larger role in China, it is important to think carefully about the ways that it leads to a deeper understanding of Marxist principles. For example, it is highly significant that process thinking appears in many places in traditional Chinese philosophy, in Confucian and Taoist thinkers, and even in the most ancient text in the Chinese philosophical tradition, the I Ching. In the end, the work of all political and economic theories will be judged by the fruits of their application. No one denies that radical changes are necessary. Indeed, it's increasingly clear that they must come quickly. Even non-Marxists know the most famous sentence Karl Marx ever wrote. The philosophers have only interpreted the world in various ways. The point, however, is to change it. We dedicate this book to all those men and women around the world, young and old, who are dedicated to building a sustainable and ecological civilization in our time. Chapter 2. Why Not Capitalism? Historical Origins. In the following chapters, we describe and advocate for organic Marxism as a framework for social, political, and economic decision-making. Developments in the natural and social sciences, in ecology, and in cultural studies make this position a serious contender in the current debate. This postmodern version of Marxism deserves serious attention not only because of its strengths, however, but also because of the weaknesses of the alternatives. In particular, it should be assessed in light of the palpable shortcomings of its capitalist competitor, which are becoming more and more visible to observers around the world. One cannot undertake this comparison without acknowledging how deeply capitalist assumptions have formed the backdrop for most thinking about economics and politics since the dawn of the modern age. Unless one pauses to carefully evaluate these background assumptions, it is impossible to seriously study and evaluate the alternatives. The criticism that is most often raised against any alternative to capitalism is that it is idealistic and utopian. The last decades have provided numerous examples of the collapse of socialist experiments. Usually, as nations fall under the increasing dominance of unrestrained capitalist practices, little attention is paid to the drawbacks of canceling policies that were in place for the common good. As wealthier individuals focus on their access to higher profits and greater diversity of buying choices, they usually pay little attention to what is being lost as the capitalist kingdom grows. Perhaps a short anecdote will help. One of this book's authors was studying in Germany in the period leading up to the fall of the Berlin Wall. Because of the abuses and mismanagement of the East German government, the German Democratic Republic, DDR, little attention was paid to the dashed hopes of this socialist experiment on German soil. On the morning following the collapse of the Berlin Wall, German newspaper reporters interviewed the East Germans who began pouring into West Berlin through the new openings in the wall. They asked, "What is it like for you to come to the West for the first time? What does it mean to you?" One expected to hear emotional comments about the importance of freedom, self-government, and the need for a more open socialist democracy. Instead, the answers were uniformly about access to products. "I need spark plugs for my moped," and "I want to buy bananas for my family," were the first answers in the article. and most of the comments that followed were similar. Only one woman said, "I just want to wander under the linden trees on the Kurfürstendamm, the famous broad avenue in West Berlin." How did the assumptions of capitalist political and economic systems become just obvious? Why do so many falsely assume that there is no alternative? Only when we have sketched the birth and history of this worldview can we begin to understand its contemporary manifestations, and only then can we accurately assess whether there are more positive alternatives. Defining capitalism. American authors like to define capitalism as the rejection of state ownership. Thus, the Merriam-Webster Dictionary suggests as its primary definition a way of organizing an economy so that the things that are used to make and transport products, such as land, oil, factories, ships, etc., are owned by individual people and companies rather than by the government. But rejection of state ownership is actually a subsidiary feature. At its most basic level, capitalism means an economic system in which the most central value and goal is the creation and increase of wealth. In such systems, wealth is measured not primarily in terms of the labor that is required to produce goods or the use value that these goods have for real people. Instead, it's measured in terms of an independent economic reality, the exchange value of these goods on the open market. Capital is the fluid currency by means of which goods are bought and sold, and in terms of which they are valued. The exchange of currency, therefore, becomes the dominant reality. Other aspects of economics, the banking system, exchange, economic institutions, work, and even social institutions, are assessed by the amount of capital that the market will pay for them. Put differently, capitalism is a way of valuing items and services that abstracts from the labor that produces them and from the real-world uses to which they are put. The rice that is eaten, the clothes that are worn, the house that a family lives in. Instead, the amount of money that investors will pay for an item is allowed to determine its value. As the scope of capitalism grows, the criterion informs value judgments for ever larger spheres of daily life. More and more, the lived experience of human social systems, and of the people who participate in them, comes to be evaluated based upon the market's decision concerning values. Perhaps an anecdote will help to make this point. Some years ago, we were guests at the house of a wealthy gentleman in Connecticut. We had heard that he used his house to display and sell art and furniture, but we were completely unprepared for what we found when we arrived. Not only every painting on the walls, but every piece of furniture in his own home had a number on it. Guests were given a price list and asked to consider making purchases during their visit. No attention was paid to the value of friendships, discussions, or the experience of sharing food together at the table. The free market had come to dominate this gentleman's home, so that everything in his private sphere was now valued according to the price that the visitors would pay for it. We did not ask whether his wife and children were also for sale. Many people, especially those who possess the most wealth, believe that the best means for structuring human society is to build it upon market-based means for assigning value. One can only evaluate this suggestion, however, by contrasting it with the alternative. What is lost when market mechanisms supersede the more ancient ways of determining the value of products, the labor that was required to produce them, and the uses that they are put to by ordinary humans, food, clothing, shelter? What happens when we turn things that are valuable in and of themselves, family, community, ecosystems, even the planet itself, into commodities to be bought and traded so that the market value replaces inherent value? One will understand the present world situation only when one has come to understand what has been lost, as the global market has come to dominate human societies and the planet. To understand the implications of the shift to a capitalist worldview, Some historical analysis is necessary. The Ideal of the State: A Brief History. To some readers, it might appear obvious that an economic and political system based on the principle of selfishness, acquisition for oneself and one's family, apart from the question of what is best for the community as a whole, would be an inferior system. After all, we already know that human beings tend to be selfish. We tend to see the world through only one pair of eyes, our own. We naturally think of our own desires before we